preparatory haircut, and he had a slightly intimidating blue-eyed gaze. He nodded in a friendly way, and Greg said, "Have we met before?"
"Perhaps," the Russian said. "I was at school in Germany, the Berlin Boys Academy."
Greg shook his head. "Ever been to the States?"
"No."
Lloyd said, "This is the guy with the same surname as you, Volodya Peshkov." Greg introduced himself. "We might be related. My father, Lev Peshkov, emigrated in 1914, leaving behind a pregnant girlfriend, who then married his older brother, Grigory Peshkov. Could we be half-brothers?" Volodya's manner altered immediately.
"Definitely not," he said. "Excuse me."
He left the bar without buying a drink.
"That was abrupt," Greg said to Lloyd.
"It was," said Lloyd. He looked kind of shocked.
"It must have been something you said."
3. It could not be true, Volodya told himself. Greg claimed that Grigory had married a girl who was already pregnant by Lev. If that was the case, the man Volodya had always called father was not his father, but his uncle. Perhaps it was a coincidence, or the American could just be stirring up trouble. All the same, Volodya was reeling with shock. He returned home at his usual time. He and Zoya were rising fast, and had been given an apartment in Government House, the luxury block where his parents lived. Grigory and Katerina came to the apartment at Kotya's supper time, as they did most evenings. Katerina bathed her grandson. Then Grigory sang to him and told him Russian fairy tales. Kotya was 9 months old, and not yet talking, but he seemed to like bedtime stories just the same. Volodya followed the evening routine as if sleepwalking. He tried to behave normally, but he found he could hardly speak to either of his parents. He did not believe Greg's story, but he could not stop thinking about it. When Kotya was asleep, and the grandparents were about to leave, Grigory said to Volodya, "Have I got a boil on my nose?"
"No."
"Then why have you been staring at me all evening?"
Volodya decided to tell the truth.
"I met a man called Greg Peshkov. He's part of the American delegation. He thinks we're related."
"It's possible."
Grigory's tone was light, as if it did not much matter. But Volodya saw that his neck had reddened, a giveaway sign of suppressed emotion in his father.
"I last saw my brother in 1919. Since then I haven't heard from him."
"Greg's father is called Lev, and Lev had a brother called Grigory."
"Then Greg could be your cousin?"
"He said brother."
Grigory's blush deepened and he said nothing. Zoya put in, "How could that be?"
Volodya said, "According to this American Peshkov, Lev had a pregnant girlfriend in St. Petersburg who married his brother."
Grigory said,
"Ridiculous."
Volodya looked at Katerina.
"You haven't said anything, mother."
There was a long pause. That in itself was significant. What did they have to think about, if there was no truth in Greg's story? A weird coldness descended on Volodya like a freezing fog. At last his mother said,
"I was a flighty girl."
She looked at Zoya.
"Not sensible, like your wife."
She sighed deeply.
"Grigory Peshkov fell in love with me, more or less at first sight, poor idiot."
She smiled fondly at her husband. "But his brother Lev had fancy clothes, cigarettes, money for vodka, gangster friends. I liked Lev better. More fool me." Volodya said amazedly, "So it's true." Part of him still hoped desperately for a denial.
"Lev did what such men always do," Katerina said. "He made me pregnant, then left me."
"So Lev is my father."
Volodya looked at Grigory.
"And you're just my uncle."
He felt as if he might fall over. The ground under his feet had shifted. It was like an earthquake. Zoya stood beside Volodya's chair and put her hand on his shoulder, as if to calm him, or perhaps restrain him. Katerina went on,
"And Grigory did what men such as Grigory always do. He took care of me. He loved me. He married me. And he provided for me and my children."
Sitting on the couch next to Grigory, she took his hand,
I didn't want him, and I certainly didn't deserve him, but God gave him to me anyway.
Grigori said, I have dreaded this day. Ever since you were born, I have dreaded it.
Volodya said, then why did you keep the secret? Why didn't you just speak the truth?
Grigori was choked up and spoke with difficulty. I couldn't bear to tell you that I wasn't your father, he managed to say. I loved you too much.
Katerina said, let me tell you something, my beloved son. Listen to me now, and I don't care if you never listen to your mother again. But hear this. Forget the stranger in America who once seduced a foolish girl. Look at the man sitting in front of you with tears in his eyes.
Volodya looked at Grigori and saw a pleading expression that tugged at his heart.
Katerina went on, this man has fed you, and clothed you, and loved you unfailingly for 3 decades. If the word father means anything at all, this is your father.
Yes, Volodya said. I know that.
4. Lloyd Williams got on well with Ernie Bevan. They had a lot in common, despite the age difference. During the 4-day train journey across snowy Europe, Lloyd had confided that he, like Bevan, was the illegitimate son of a housemaid. They were both passionate anti-communists. Lloyd because of his experiences in Spain, Bevan because he had seen communist tactics in the trade union movement. They're slaves to the Kremlin and tyrants over everyone else, Bevan said, and Lloyd knew exactly what he meant. Lloyd had not warmed to Greg Peshkov, who always looked as if he had dressed in a rush, shirt sleeves unbuttoned, coat collar twisted, shoelaces untied. Greg was shrewd, and Lloyd tried to like him, but he felt that underneath Greg's casual charm there was a core of ruthlessness. Daisy had said that Lev Peshkov was a gangster, and Lloyd could imagine that Greg had the same instincts. However, Bevan jumped at Greg's idea for Germany. Was he speaking for Marshall, do you suppose? Said the portly foreign secretary in his broad West Country accent. He said not, Lloyd replied. Do you think it could work? I think it's the best idea I've heard in 3 bloody weeks in bloody Moscow. If he's serious, arrange an informal lunch. Just Marshall and this youngster with you and me. I'll do it right away. But tell nobody. We don't want the Soviets to get a whisper of this. They'll accuse us of conspiring against them, and they'll be right.
They met the following day at No. 10 Spasso-Peskovskaya Square, the American ambassador's residence, an extravagant neoclassical mansion built before the revolution. Marshall was tall and lean, every inch a soldier. Bevan, rotund, nearsighted, a cigarette frequently dangling from his lips, but they clicked immediately. Both were plain-speaking men. Bevan had once been accused of ungentlemanly speech by Stalin himself, a distinction of which the foreign secretary was very proud. Beneath the painted ceilings and chandeliers, they got down to the task of reviving Germany without the help of the USSR. They agreed rapidly on the principles: the new currency, the unification of the British, American, and, if possible, French zones, the demilitarization of West Germany, elections, and a new transatlantic military alliance. Then Bevan said bluntly, none of this will work, you know. Marshall was taken aback. Then I fail to understand why we're discussing it, he said sharply. Europe's in a slump. This scheme will fail if people are starving. The best protection against communism is prosperity. Stalin knows that, which is why he wants to keep Germany impoverished. I agree, which means we've got to rebuild. But we can't do it with our bare hands. We need tractors, lathes, excavators, rolling stock, all of which we can't afford. Marshall saw where he was going. Americans aren't willing to give Europeans any more handouts. Fair enough. But there must be a way the USA can lend us the money we need to buy equipment from you. There was a silence. Marshall hated to waste words, but this was a long pause even by his standards. Then at last he spoke. It makes sense, he said. I'll see what I can do. The conference lasted 6 weeks, and when they all went home again, nothing had been decided.
5. Ava Williams was a year old when she got her back teeth. The others had come fairly easily, but these hurt. There was not much Lloyd and Daisy could do for her. She was miserable. She could not sleep. She would not let them sleep, and they were miserable too. Daisy had a lot of money, but they lived unostentatiously. They had bought a pleasant row house in Hoxton, where their neighbors were a shopkeeper and a builder. They got a small family car, a new Morris 8, with a top speed of almost 60 miles per hour. Daisy still bought pretty clothes, but Lloyd had just three suits: evening dress, a chalk stripe for the House of Commons, and tweeds for constituency work at the weekends. Lloyd was in his pajamas late one evening, trying to rock the grizzling Evie to sleep, and at the same time leafing through Life magazine. He noticed a striking photograph taken in Moscow. It showed a Russian woman wearing a headscarf and a coat tied with string like a parcel, her old face deeply lined, shoveling snow on the street. Something about the way the light struck her gave her a look of timelessness, as if she had been there for 1,000 years. He looked for the photographer's name and found it was Woody Doer, whom he had met at the conference. The phone rang. He picked it up and heard the voice of Ernie Bevin. "Turn your wireless on," Bevin said. "Marshall's made a speech." He hung up without waiting for a reply. Lloyd went downstairs to the living room, still carrying Evie, and switched on the radio. The show was called American Commentary. The BBC's Washington correspondent, Leonard Mile, was reporting from Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. "The Secretary of State told alumni that the rebuilding of Europe is going to take a longer time and require a greater effort than was originally foreseen," said Mile. That was promising, Lloyd thought with excitement. "Hush, Evie, please," he said, and for once she quietened. Then Lloyd heard the low, reasonable voice of George C. Marshall. "Europe's requirements for the next 3 or 4 years of foreign food and other essential products, principally from America, are so much greater than her present ability to pay that she must have substantial additional help, or face economic, social, and political deterioration of a very grave character." Lloyd was electrified. Substantial additional help was what Bevin had asked for. "The remedy lies in breaking the vicious circle and restoring the confidence of the European people in the economic future," Marshall said. "The United States should do whatever it is able to assist in the return of normal economic health in the world." "He's done it," Lloyd said triumphantly to his uncomprehending baby daughter. "He's told America they have to give us aid. But how much, and how, and when?" The voice changed, and the reporter said, "The Secretary of State did not outline a detailed plan for aid to Europe, but said it was up to the Europeans to draft the program." "Does that mean we have carte blanche?" Lloyd eagerly asked Evie. Marshall's voice returned to say, "The initiative, I think, must come from Europe." The report ended, and the phone rang again. "Did you hear that?" said Bevin. "What does it mean?" "Don't ask," said Bevin. "If you ask questions, you get answers you don't want." "All right," Lloyd said, baffled. "Never mind what he meant. The question is what we do. The initiative must come from Europe," he said. "That means me and you."
"What can I do?"
"Pack a bag," said Bevin. "We're going to Paris." Chapter 24 1948. Volodya was in Prague as part of a Red Army delegation holding talks with the Czech military. They were staying in Art Deco splendor at the Imperial Hotel. It was snowing. He missed Zoya and little Kotya. His son was 2 years old and learning new words at bewildering speed. The child was changing so fast that he seemed different every day. And Zoya was pregnant again. Volodya resented having to spend 2 weeks apart from his family. Most of the men in the group saw the trip as a chance to get away from their wives, drink too much vodka, and maybe fool around with loose women. Volodya just wanted to go home. The military talks were genuine, but Volodya's part in them was a cover for his real assignment, which was to report on the activities in Prague of the ham-fisted Soviet secret police, perennial rivals of Red Army intelligence. Volodya had little enthusiasm for his work nowadays. Everything he had once believed in had been undermined. He no longer had faith in Stalin, communism, or the essential goodness of the Russian people. Even his father was not his father. He would have defected to the West if he could have found a way of getting Zoya and Kotya out with him. However, he did have his heart in his mission here in Prague. It was a rare chance to do something he believed in. 2 weeks ago, the Czech Communist Party had taken full control of the government, ousting their coalition partners. Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk, a war hero and democratic anti-communist, had become a prisoner on the top floor of his official residence, the Tsiernin Palace. The Soviet secret police had undoubtedly been behind the coup. In fact, Volodya's brother-in-law, Colonel Ilya Dvorkin, was also in Prague, staying at the same hotel, and had almost certainly been involved. Volodya's boss, General Lemitov, saw the coup as a public relations catastrophe for the USSR. Masaryk had constituted proof to the world that East European countries could be free and independent in the shadow of the USSR. He had enabled Czechoslovakia to have a communist government friendly to the Soviet Union and at the same time wear the costume of bourgeois democracy. This had been the perfect arrangement, for it gave the USSR everything it wanted, while reassuring the Americans. But that equilibrium had been upset. However, Ilya was crowing. "The bourgeois parties have been smashed," he said to Volodya in the hotel bar one night. "Did you see what happened in the American Senate?" Volodya said mildly. "Vandenberg, the old isolationist, made an 80-minute speech in favor of the Marshall Plan, and he was cheered to the rafters." George Marshall's vague ideas had become a plan. This was mainly thanks to the rat-like cunning of British Foreign Secretary Ernie Bevin. In Volodya's opinion, Bevin was the most dangerous kind of anti-communist, a working-class social democrat. Despite his bulk, he moved fast. With lightning speed, he had organized a conference in Paris that had given a resounding collective European welcome to George Marshall's Harvard speech. Volodya knew, from spies in the British Foreign Office, that Bevin was determined to bring Germany into the Marshall Plan and keep the USSR out. And Stalin had fallen straight into Bevin's trap by commanding the East European countries to repudiate Marshall aid. Now the Soviet secret police seemed to be doing all they could to assist the passage of the bill through Congress. "The Senate was all set to reject Marshall," Volodya said to Ilya. "American taxpayers don't want to foot the bill, but the coup here in Prague has persuaded them that they have to, because European capitalism is in danger of collapse." Ilya said indignantly, "The bourgeois Czech parties wanted to take the American bribe." "We should have let them," said Volodya. "It might have been the quickest way to sabotage the whole scheme. Congress would then have rejected the Marshall Plan. They don't want to give money to communists." "The Marshall Plan is an imperialist trick." "Yes, it is," said Volodya, "and I'm afraid it's working. Our wartime allies are forming an anti-Soviet bloc. People who obstruct the forward march of communism must be dealt with appropriately." "Indeed they must." It was amazing how consistently people such as Ilya made the wrong political judgments. "And I must go to bed." It was only 10, but Volodya went too. He lay awake, thinking about Zoya and Kotya, and wishing he could kiss them both goodnight. His thoughts drifted to his mission. He had met Jan Masaryk, the symbol of Czech independence, 2 days earlier, at a ceremony at the grave of his father, Tomas Masaryk, the founder and first president of Czechoslovakia. Dressed in a coat with a fur collar, head bared to the falling snow, the second Masaryk had seemed beaten and depressed. If he could be persuaded to stay on as foreign minister, some compromise might be possible, Volodya mused. Czechoslovakia could have a thoroughly communist domestic government, but in its international relations, it might be neutral, or at least minimally anti-American. Masaryk had both the diplomatic skills and the international credibility to walk that tightrope. Volodya decided he would suggest it to Lemitov tomorrow. He slept fitfully, and woke before 6 o'clock, with a mental alarm ringing in his imagination. It was something about last night's conversation with Ilya. Volodya ran over it again in his mind.
When Ilya had said, "People who obstruct the forward march of communism," he had been talking about Masaryk. And when a secret policeman said someone had to be dealt with appropriately, he always meant killed. Then Ilya had gone to bed early, which suggested an early start this morning. "I'm a fool," Volodya thought. "The signs were there and it took me all night to read them." He leaped out of bed. Perhaps he was not too late. He dressed quickly and put on a heavy overcoat, scarf and hat. There were no taxis outside the hotel. It was too early. He could have called a Red Army car, but by the time a driver was awakened and the car brought, it would have taken the best part of an hour. He set out to walk. The Tsiernin Palace was only a mile or two away. He headed west out of Prague's gracious city center, crossed the Charles Bridge, and hurried uphill toward the castle. Masaryk was not expecting him, nor was the foreign minister obliged to give audience to a Red Army colonel, but Volodya felt sure Masaryk would be curious enough to see him. He walked fast through the snow and reached the Tsiernin Palace at 6:45. It was a huge Baroque building with a grandiose row of Corinthian half-columns on the three upper stories. The place was lightly guarded, he found to his surprise. A sentry pointed to the front door. Volodya walked unchallenged through an ornate hall. He had expected to find the usual secret police moron behind a reception desk, but there was no one. This was a bad sign, and he was filled with foreboding. The hall led to an inner courtyard. Glancing through a window, he saw what looked like a man sleeping in the snow. Perhaps he had fallen there drunk. If so, he was in danger of freezing to death. Volodya tried the door and found it open. He ran across the quadrangle. A man in blue silk pajamas lay face down on the ground. There was no snow covering him, so he could not have been there many minutes. Volodya knelt beside him. The man was quite still and did not appear to be breathing. Volodya looked up. Rows of identical windows, like soldiers on parade, looked into this courtyard. All were closed tightly against the freezing weather, except one, high above the man in pajamas, that stood wide open, as if someone had been thrown out of it. Volodya turned the lifeless head and looked at the man's face. It was Jan Masaryk. 2. 3 days later in Washington, the Joint Chiefs of Staff presented to President Truman an emergency war plan to meet a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. The danger of a Third World War was a hot topic in the press. "We just won the war," Jackie Jakes said to Greg Peshkov. "How come we're about to have another?"
"That's what I keep asking myself," said Greg. They were sitting on a park bench while Greg took a breather from throwing a football with Georgie.
"I'm glad he's too young to fight," Jackie said.
"Me too." They both looked at their son, standing talking to a blonde girl about his age. The laces of his keds were undone and his shirt was untucked. He was 12 years old and growing up. He had a few soft black hairs on his upper lip, and he seemed 3 inches taller than last week.
"We've been bringing our troops home as fast as we can," Greg said.
"So have the British and the French. But the Red Army stayed put. Result? They now have 3 times as many soldiers in Germany as we do."
"Americans don't want another war."
"You can say that again. And Truman hopes to win the presidential election in November, so he's going to do everything he can to avoid war. But it may happen anyway."
"You're getting out of the army soon. What are you going to do?"
There was a quaver in her voice that made him suspect the question was not as casual as she pretended. He looked at her face, but her expression was unreadable. He answered,
"Assuming America is not at war, I'm going to run for Congress in 1950. My father has agreed to finance my campaign. I'll start as soon as the presidential election is over."
She looked away.
"Which party?"
She asked the question mechanically. He wondered if he had said something to upset her. "Republican, of course."
"What about marriage?"
Greg was taken aback.
"Why do you ask that?"
She was looking hard at him now.
"Are you getting married?"
she persisted. "As it happens, I am. Her name is Nellie Fordham."
"I thought so. How old is she?"
22.
"What do you mean you thought so?"
"A politician needs a wife."
"I love her."
"Sure you do.
Is her family in politics?"
Her father is a Washington lawyer.
Good choice.
Greg felt annoyed. You're being very cynical.
I know you, Greg.
Good Lord, I fucked you when you weren't much older than Georgie is now. You can fool everyone except your mother and me. She was perceptive, as always. His mother had also been critical of his engagement. They were right. It was a career move. But Nellie was pretty and charming, and she adored Greg. So what was so wrong? I'm meeting her for lunch near here in a few minutes, he said. Jackie said, does Nellie know about Georgie?
No.
And we must keep it that way.
You're right.
Having an illegitimate child is bad enough. A black one could ruin your career.
I know. Almost as bad as a black wife.
Greg was so surprised that he came right out with it.
Did you think I was going to marry you?
She looked sour.
Hell no, Greg. If I was given a choice between you and the acid bath murderer, I'd ask for time to think about it.
She was lying, he knew. For a moment he contemplated the idea of marrying Jackie. Interracial marriages were unusual and attracted a good deal of hostility from blacks as well as whites, but some people did it and put up with the consequences. He had never met a girl he liked as much as Jackie, not even Margaret Cowdrey, whom he had dated for a couple of years until she got fed up of waiting for him to propose. Jackie was sharp-tongued, but he liked that, maybe because his mother was the same. There was something deeply attractive about the idea of the three of them being together all the time. Georgie would learn to call him Dad. They could buy a house in a neighborhood where people were broad-minded, someplace that had a lot of students and young professors, maybe Georgetown. Then he saw Georgie's blonde friend being called away by her parents, a cross-white mother wagging a finger in admonition, and he realized that marrying Jackie was the worst idea in the world. Georgie returned to where Greg and Jackie sat.
How's school? Greg asked him. I like it better than I used to, the boy said. Math is getting more interesting.
I was good at math, Greg said.
Jackie said, now there's a coincidence. Greg stood up. I have to go. He squeezed Georgie's shoulder. Keep working on the math, buddy.
Sure, said Georgie.
Greg waved at Jackie and left. She had been thinking about marriage at the same time as he, no doubt. She knew that coming out of the army was a decision moment for him. It forced him to think about his future. She could not really have thought he would marry her. But all the same, she must have harbored a secret fantasy. Now he had shattered it. Well, that was too bad. Even if she had been white, he would not have married her. He was fond of her, and he loved the kid. But he had his whole life ahead of him, and he wanted a wife who would bring him connections and support. Nellie's father was a powerful man in Republican politics. He walked to the Napoli, an Italian restaurant a few blocks from the park. Nellie was already there, her copper-red curls escaping from under a little green hat.
You look great, he said. I hope I'm not late.
He sat down. Nellie's face was stony.
I saw you in the park, she said.
Greg thought, oh shit.
I was a little early, so I sat for a while, she said. You didn't notice me. Then I started to feel like a snoop, so I left.
So you saw my godson, he said with forced cheerfulness.
Is that who he is?
You're a surprising choice for a godfather.
You never even go to church.
I'm good to the kid.
What's his name?
Georgie Jakes.
You've never mentioned him before.
Haven't I?
How old is he?
12.
So you were 16 when he was born? That's young to be a godfather.
I guess it is.
What does his mother do for a living?
She's a waitress. Years ago she was an actress. Her stage name was Jackie Jinks. I met her when she was under contract to my father's studio.
That was more or less true, Greg thought uncomfortably.
And his father?
Greg shook his head. Jackie is single. A waiter approached. Greg said, how about a cocktail? Perhaps it might ease the tension.
Two martinis, he said to the waiter.
Right away, sir.
As soon as the waiter had left, Nellie said,
you're the boy's father, aren't you?
Godfather.
Her voice became contemptuous.
Oh, stop it.
What makes you so sure? He may be black, but he looks like you. He can't keep his shoelaces tied or his shirt tucked in, and nor can you.
and he was charming the pants off that little blonde girl he was talking to. Of course he's yours. Greg gave in. He sighed and said,
I was going to tell you.
When?
I was waiting for the right moment.
Before you proposed would have been a good time?
I'm sorry. He was embarrassed, but not really contrite. He thought she was making an unnecessary fuss. The waiter brought menus and they both looked at them.
The spaghetti bolognese is great, said Greg.
I'm going to get a salad.
Their martinis arrived. Greg raised his glass and said,
To forgiveness in marriage.
Nellie did not pick up her drink.
I can't marry you, she said.
Honey, come on. Don't overreact. I've apologized. She shook her head.
You don't get it, do you?
What don't I get? That woman sitting on the park bench with you.
She loves you.
Does she? Greg would have denied it yesterday, but after today's conversation he was not sure.
Of course she does. Why hasn't she married again? She's pretty enough. By now she could have found a man willing to take on a stepson, if she'd really been trying. But she's in love with you, you rotter.
I'm not so sure. And the boy adores you too. I'm his favorite uncle.
Except that you're not.
She pushed her glass across the table.
You have my drink.
Honey, please, relax.
I'm leaving.
She stood up. Greg was not used to girls walking out on him. He found it unnerving. Was he losing his allure?
I want to marry you, he said.
He sounded desperate, even to himself.
You can't marry me, Greg, she said.
She slipped the diamond ring off her finger and put it down on the red checked tablecloth.
You already have a family.
She walked out of the restaurant. 3. The world crisis came to a head in June, and Carla and her family were at the center of it. The Marshall Plan had been signed into law by President Truman, and the first shipments of aid were arriving in Europe, to the fury of the Kremlin. On Friday, June 18th, the Western Allies alerted Germans that they would make an important announcement at 8 o'clock that evening. Carla's family gathered around the radio in the kitchen, tuned to Radio Frankfurt, and waited anxiously. The war had been over for 3 years, yet still they did not know what the future held. Capitalism or communism, unity or fragmentation, freedom or subjugation, prosperity or destitution. Werner sat beside Carla with Vali, now 2½, on his knee. They had married quietly a year ago. Carla was working as a nurse again. She was also a Berlin city councillor for the Social Democrats. So was Frieda's husband, Heinrich. In East Germany, the Russians had banned the Social Democratic Party, but Berlin was an oasis in the Soviet sector, ruled by a council of the four main allies called the Kommandatura, which had vetoed the ban. As a result, the Social Democrats had won, and the communists had come a poor third after the conservative Christian Democrats. The Russians were incensed, and did everything they could to obstruct the elected council. Carla found it frustrating, but she could not give up the hope of independence from the Soviets. Werner had managed to start a small business. He had searched through the ruins of his father's factory and scavenged a small hoard of electrical supplies and radio parts. Germans could not afford to buy new radios, but everyone wanted their old ones repaired. Werner had found some engineers, formerly employed at the factory, and set them to work fixing broken wireless sets. He was the manager and salesman, going to houses and apartment buildings, knocking on doors, drumming up business. Maud, also at the kitchen table this evening, worked as an interpreter for the Americans. She was one of the best, and often translated at meetings of the Kommandatura. Carla's brother, Eric, was wearing the uniform of a policeman. Having joined the Communist Party, to the dismay of his family, he had got a job as a police officer in the new East German force organized by the Russian occupiers. Eric said the Western Allies were trying to split Germany in two. You Social Democrats are secessionists, he said, quoting the communist line in the same way he had parroted Nazi propaganda.
The Western Allies haven't divided anything, Carla retorted. They've opened the borders between their zones. Why don't the Soviets do the same? Then we could be one country again.
He seemed not to hear her. Rebecca was almost 17. Carla and Werner had legally adopted her. She was doing well at school and good at languages. Carla was pregnant again, though she had not told Werner. She was thrilled. He had an adopted daughter and a stepson, but now he would have a child of his own as well. She knew he would be delighted when she told him. She was waiting a little longer to be sure. But she yearned to know in what kind of country her three children were going to live. An American officer called Robert Lochner came on the air. He had been raised in Germany and spoke the language effortlessly. Beginning at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, he explained, West Germany would have a new currency, the Deutsche Mark. Carla was not surprised. The Reichsmark was worth less every day. Most people were paid in Reichsmarks, if they had a job at all, and the currency could be used for basics such as food rations and bus fares, but everyone preferred to get groceries or cigarettes. Werner, in his business, charged people in Reichsmarks, but offered overnight service for 5 cigarettes and delivery anywhere in the city for 3 eggs. Carla knew from Maud that the new currency had been discussed at the Kommandantur. The Russians had demanded plates so that they could print it, but they had debased the old currency by printing too much, and there was no point in a new currency if the same thing was going to happen. Consequently, the West refused and the Soviets sulked. Now the West had decided to go ahead without the cooperation of the Soviets. Carla was pleased, for the new currency would be good for Germany, but she felt apprehensive about the Soviet reaction. People in West Germany could exchange 60 inflated old Reichsmarks for 3 Deutschmarks and 90 new pennies, said Lochner. Then he said that none of this would apply in Berlin, at least at first, whereupon there was a collective groan in the kitchen. Carla went to bed wondering what the Soviets would do. She lay beside Werner, part of her brain listening in case Vali, in the next room, should cry. The Soviet occupiers had been getting angrier for the last few months. A journalist called Dieter Frieda had been kidnapped in the American zone by the Soviet secret police, then held captive. The Soviets at first denied all knowledge, then said they had arrested him as a spy. 3 students had been expelled from university for criticizing the Russians in a magazine. Worst of all, a Soviet fighter aircraft buzzed a British European Airways passenger plane landing at Gatow Airport and clipped its wing, causing both planes to crash and killing 4 BEA crew, 10 passengers, and the Soviet pilot. When the Russians got angry, someone else always suffered. Next morning, the Soviets announced it would be a crime to import Deutschmarks into East Germany. This included Berlin, the statement said, which is part of the Soviet zone. The Americans immediately denounced this phrase and affirmed that Berlin was an international city, but the temperature was rising, and Carla remained anxious. On Monday, West Germany got the new currency. On Tuesday, a Red Army courier came to Carla's house and summoned her to City Hall. She had been summoned this way before, but all the same she was fearful as she left home. There was nothing to stop the Soviets imprisoning her. The communists had all the same arbitrary powers the Nazis had assumed. They were even using the old concentration camps. The famous Red City Hall had been damaged by bombing, and the city government was based in the new City Hall, in Parochialstrasse. Both buildings were in the Mitte district, where Carla lived, which was in the Soviet zone. When she got there, she found that acting mayor Louise Schroeder and others had also been called for a meeting with the Soviet liaison officer, Major Utschkin. He informed them that the East German currency was to be reformed, and in future only the new Ostmark would be legal in the Soviet zone. Acting mayor Schroeder immediately saw the crucial point. Are you telling us that this will apply in all sectors of Berlin?
Yes.
Frau Schroeder was not easily intimidated.
Under the city constitution, the Soviet occupying power cannot make such a rule for the other sectors, she said firmly. The other allies must be consulted.
They will not object. He handed over a sheet of paper. This is Marshal Sokolovsky's decree. You will bring it before the city council tomorrow.
Later that evening, as Carla got into bed with Werner, she said,
you can see what the Soviet tactic is. If the city council were to pass the decree, it would be difficult for the democratically minded Western allies to overturn it. But the council won't pass it. The communists are a minority, and no one else will want the Ostmark.
No.
Which is why I'm wondering what Marshal Sokolovsky has up his sleeve. The next morning's newspapers announced that, from Friday, there would be two competing currencies in Berlin, the Ostmark and the Deutsche Mark. It turned out that the Americans had secretly flown in 250 million in the new currency in wooden boxes marked Clay and Bird Dog, which were now stashed all over Berlin. During the day, Carla began to hear rumors from West Germany. The new money had brought about a miracle there. Overnight, more goods had appeared in shop windows. Baskets of cherries and neatly tied bundles of carrots from the surrounding countryside, butter and eggs and pastries, and long-hoarded luxuries, such as new shoes, handbags, and even stockings, at 4 Deutschmarks the pair. People had been waiting until they could sell things for real money. That afternoon, Carla set off for City Hall to attend the council meeting, scheduled for 4 o'clock. As she drew near, she saw dozens of Red Army trucks parked in the streets around the building, their drivers lounging around, smoking. They were mostly American vehicles that must have been given to the USSR as lend-lease aid during the war. She got an inkling of their purpose when she began to hear the sound of an unruly mob. What the Soviet governor had up his sleeve, she suspected, was a truncheon. In front of City Hall, red flags fluttered above a crowd of several thousand, most of them wearing Communist Party badges. Loudspeaker trucks blared angry speeches, and the crowd chanted, "Down with the secessionists!" Carla did not see how she was going to reach the building. A handful of policemen looked on uninterestedly, making no attempt to help councillors get through. It reminded Carla painfully of the attitude of police on the day the brown shirts had trashed her mother's office, 15 years ago. She was quite sure the communist councillors were already inside, and that if Social Democrats did not get into the building, the minority would pass the decree and claim it to be valid. She took a deep breath and began to push through the crowd. For a few steps, she made progress unnoticed. Then someone recognized her. "American whore!" he yelled, pointing at her. She pressed on determinedly. Someone else spat at her, and a gob of saliva smeared her dress. She kept going, but she felt panicky. She was surrounded by people who hated her, something she had never experienced, and it made her want to run away. She was shoved, but managed to keep her feet. A hand grasped her dress, and she pulled free with a tearing sound. She wanted to scream. What would they do? Rip all her clothes off? Someone else was fighting his way through the crowd behind her, she realized, and she looked back and saw Heinrich von Kessel, Frieda's husband. He drew level with her and they battled on together. Heinrich was more aggressive, stamping on toes and vigorously elbowing everyone within range, and together they moved faster, and at last reached the door and went in. But their ordeal was not over. There were communist demonstrators inside, too, hundreds of them. They had to fight through the corridors. In the meeting hall, the demonstrators were everywhere, not just in the visitors' gallery, but on the floor of the chamber. Their behavior here was just as aggressive as outside. Some Social Democrats were here, and others arrived after Carla. Somehow most of the 63 had been able to fight their way through the mob. She was relieved. The enemy had not managed to scare them off. When the Speaker of the Assembly called for order, a communist assemblyman, standing on a bench, urged the demonstrators to stay. When he saw Carla, he yelled, "Traitors, stay outside!" It was all grimly reminiscent of 1933. Bullying, intimidation, and democracy being undermined by rowdyism. Carla was in despair. Glancing up to the gallery, she was appalled to see her brother, Eric, among the yelling mob. "You're German," she screamed at him. "You lived under the Nazis. Have you learnt nothing?" He seemed not to hear her. Frau Schröder stood on the platform, calling for calm. She was jeered and booed by the demonstrators. Raising her voice to a shout, she said, "If the city council cannot hold an orderly debate in this building, I will move the meeting to the American sector." There was renewed abuse,
but the 26 communist councillors saw that this move would not suit their purpose. If the council met outside the Soviet zone once, it might do so again, and even move permanently out of the range of communist intimidation. After a short discussion, one of them stood up and told the demonstrators to leave. They filed out, singing the Internationale.
"It's obvious whose command they're under," Heinrich said.
At last there was quiet. Frau Schröder explained the Soviet demand, and said that it could not apply outside the Soviet sector of Berlin unless it was ratified by the other allies. A communist deputy made a speech accusing her of taking orders directly from New York. Accusations and abuse raged to and fro. Eventually they voted. The communists unanimously backed the Soviet decree, after accusing others of being controlled from outside. Everyone else voted against, and the motion was defeated. Berlin had refused to be bullied. Carla felt wearily triumphant. However, it was not yet over. By the time they left, it was 7 o'clock in the evening. Most of the mob had disappeared, but there was a thuggish, hard core still hanging around the entrance. An elderly woman councillor was kicked and punched as she left. The police looked on with indifference. Carla and Heinrich left by a side door with a few friends, hoping to depart unobserved. But a communist on a bicycle was monitoring the exit. He rode off, quickly. As the councillors hurried away, he returned at the head of a small gang. Someone tripped Carla, and she fell to the ground. She was kicked painfully, once, twice, three times. Terrified, she covered her belly with her hands. She was almost 3 months pregnant, the stage at which most miscarriages occurred, she knew. "Will Werner's baby die?" she thought desperately. "Kicked to death on a Berlin street by communist thugs?" Then they disappeared. The councillors picked themselves up. No one was badly injured. They moved off together, fearful of a recurrence. But it seemed the communists had roughed up enough people for one day. Carla got home at 8 o'clock. There was no sign of Eric. Werner was shocked to see her bruises and torn dress.
"What happened?" he said. "Are you all right?"
She burst into tears.
"You're hurt," Werner said. "Should we go to the hospital?"
She shook her head vigorously.
"It's not that," she said. "I'm just bruised. I've had worse."
She slumped in a chair.
"Christ, I'm tired." "Who did this?"
he asked angrily.
"The usual people,"
she said. "They called themselves communists instead of Nazis, but they're the same type. It's 1933 all over again." Werner put his arms around her. She could not be consoled.
"The bullies and the thugs have been in power for so long," she sobbed. "Will it ever end?"
4. That night the Soviet news agency put out an announcement. From 6 o'clock in the morning, all passenger and freight transport in and out of West Berlin, trains, cars and canal barges, would be stopped. No supplies of any kind would get through. No food, no milk, no medicines, no coal. Because the electricity generating stations would therefore be shut down, they were switching off the supply of electricity to Western sectors only. The city was under siege. Lloyd Williams was at British military headquarters. There was a short parliamentary recess, and Ernie Bevin had gone on holiday to Sandbanks, on the south coast of England. But he was worried enough to send Lloyd to Berlin to observe the introduction of the new currency and keep him informed. Daisy had not accompanied Lloyd. Their new baby, Davy, was only 6 months old. And anyway, Daisy and Eva Murray were organizing a birth control clinic for women in Hoxton that was about to open its doors. Lloyd was desperately afraid that this crisis would lead to war. He had fought in 2 wars, and he never wanted to see a third. He had 2 small children who he hoped would grow up in a peaceful world. He was married to the prettiest, sexiest, most lovable woman on the planet, and he wanted to spend many long decades with her. General Clay, the workaholic American military governor, ordered his staff to plan an armored convoy that would barrel down the Autobahn from Helmstedt in the west, straight through Soviet territory to Berlin, sweeping all before it. Lloyd heard about this plan at the same time as the British governor, Sir Brian Robertson, and heard him say in his clipped, soldierly tones, "If Clay does that, it will be war." but nothing else made any sense. The Americans came up with other suggestions, Lloyd heard, talking to Clay's younger aides. The Secretary of the Army, Kenneth Royal, wanted to halt the currency reform. Clay told him it had gone too far to be reversed. Next, Royal proposed evacuating all Americans. Clay told him that was exactly what the Soviets wanted. Sir Brian wanted to supply the city by air. Most people thought that was impossible. Someone calculated that Berlin required 4,000 tons of fuel and food per day. Were there enough airplanes in the world to move that much stuff? No one knew. Nevertheless, Sir Brian ordered the Royal Air Force to make a start. On Friday afternoon, Sir Brian went to see Clay, and Lloyd was invited to be part of the entourage. Sir Brian said to Clay, "The Russians might block the Autobahn ahead of your convoy, and wait and see if you have the nerve to attack them. But I don't think they'll shoot planes down."
"I don't see how we can deliver enough supplies by air," Clay said again.
"Nor do I," said Sir Brian, "but we're going to do it until we think of something better." Clay picked up the phone.
"Get me General LeMay in Wiesbaden," he said. After a minute, he said, "Curtis, have you got any planes there that can carry coal?"
There was a pause.
"Coal," said Clay more loudly.
Another pause.
"Yes, that is what I said. Coal."
A moment later, Clay looked up at Sir Brian.
"He says the U.S. Air Force can deliver anything."
The British returned to their headquarters. On Saturday, Lloyd got an army driver and went into the Soviet zone on a personal mission. He drove to the address at which he had visited the von Ulrich family 15 years ago. He knew that Maud was still living there. His mother and Maud had resumed correspondence at the end of the war. Maud's letters put a brave face on what was undoubtedly severe hardship. She did not ask for help, and anyway, there was nothing Ethel could do for her. Rationing was still in force in Britain. The place looked very different. In 1933 it had been a fine townhouse, a little run down but still gracious. Now it looked like a dump. Most of the windows had boards or paper instead of glass. There were bullet holes in the stonework, and the garden wall had collapsed. The woodwork had not been painted for many years. Lloyd sat in the car for a few moments, looking at the house. Last time he came here, he had been 18, and Hitler had only just become Chancellor of Germany. The young Lloyd had not dreamed of the horrors the world was going to see. Neither he nor anyone else had suspected how close fascism would come to triumphing over all Europe, and how much they would have to sacrifice to defeat it. He felt a bit like the von Ulrich house looked, battered and bombed and shot at, but still standing. He walked up the path and knocked. He recognized the maid who opened the door.
"Hello, Ada. Do you remember me?" he said in German. "I'm Lloyd Williams."
The house was better inside than out. Ada showed him up to the drawing room, where there were flowers in a glass tumbler on the piano. A brightly patterned blanket had been thrown over the sofa, no doubt to hide holes in the upholstery. The newspapers in the windows let in a surprising amount of light. A 2-year-old boy walked into the room and inspected him with frank curiosity. He was dressed in clothes that were evidently homemade, and he had an oriental look.
"Who are you?" he said.
"My name is Lloyd. Who are you?"
"Vali,"
he said. He ran out again, and Lloyd heard him say to someone outside,
"That man talks funny."
So much for my German accent, Lloyd thought. Then he heard the voice of a middle-aged woman.
"Don't make such remarks. It's impolite. Sorry, Grandma."
Next moment, Maud walked in. Her appearance shocked Lloyd. She was in her mid-50s but looked 70. Her hair was grey, her face was gaunt, and her blue silk dress was threadbare. She kissed his cheek with shrunken lips.
"Lloyd Williams, what a joy to see you."
"She's my aunt," Lloyd thought with a rather queer feeling, but she did not know that. Ethel had kept the secret. Maud was followed by Carla, who was unrecognizable, and her husband. Lloyd had met Carla as a precocious 11-year-old. Now he calculated she was 26. Although she looked half-starved, most Germans did, she was pretty, and had a confident air that surprised Lloyd.
Something about the way she stood made him think she might be pregnant. He knew from Maud's letters that Carla had married Werner, who had been a handsome charmer back in 1933 and was still the same. They spent an hour catching up. The family had been through unimaginable horror, and said so frankly. Yet Lloyd still had a sense that they were editing out the worst details. He told them about Daisy, Evie, and Davy. During the conversation, a teenage girl came in and asked Carla if she could go to her friend's house. "This is our daughter Rebecca," Carla said to Lloyd. She was about 16, so Lloyd supposed she must be adopted. "Have you done your homework?" Carla asked the girl. "I'll do it tomorrow morning." "Do it now, please," Carla said firmly. "Oh, Mother!" "No argument," said Carla. She turned back to Lloyd, and Rebecca stomped out. They talked about the crisis. Carla was deeply involved as a city councillor. She was pessimistic about the future of Berlin. She thought the Russians would simply starve the population until the West gave in and handed the city over to total Soviet control. "Let me show you something that may make you feel differently," Lloyd said. "Will you come with me in my car?" Maud stayed behind with Vali, but Carla and Werner went with Lloyd. He told the driver to take them to Tempelhof, the airport in the American zone. When they arrived, he led them to a high window from which they could look down on the runway. There on the tarmac were a dozen C-47 Skytrain aircraft, lined up nose to tail, some with the American Star, some with the RAF Roundel. Their cargo doors were open, and a truck stood at each one. German porters and American airmen were unloading the aircraft. There were sacks of flour, big drums of kerosene, cartons of medical supplies, and wooden crates containing thousands of bottles of milk. While they watched, empty aircraft were taking off, and more were coming in to land.
"This is amazing," said Carla, her eyes glistening. "I've never seen anything like it."
"There has never been anything like it," Lloyd replied. She said,
"But can the British and Americans keep it up?"
"I think we have to."
"But for how long?"
"As long as it takes," said Lloyd firmly. And they did. Chapter 25 1949. Almost halfway through the 20th century, on August 29, 1949, Volodya Peshkov was on the Ust-Yurt Plateau, east of the Caspian Sea in Kazakhstan. It was a stony desert in the deep south of the USSR, where nomads herded goats in much the same way as they had in Bible times. Volodya was in a military truck that bounced uncomfortably along a rough track. Dawn was breaking over a landscape of rock, sand, and low thorny bushes. A bony camel, alone beside the road, stared malevolently at the truck as it passed. In the dim distance, Volodya saw the bomb tower, lit by a battery of spotlights. Zoya and the other scientists had built their first nuclear bomb according to the design Volodya had got from Willy Frunze in Santa Fe. It was a plutonium device with an implosion trigger. There were other designs, but this one had worked twice before, once in New Mexico and once at Nagasaki. So it should work today. The test was codenamed RDS-1, but they called it First Lightning. Volodya's truck pulled up at the foot of the tower. Looking up, he saw a clutch of scientists on the platform, doing something with a snake's nest of cables that led to detonators on the skin of the bomb. A figure in blue overalls stepped back, and there was a toss of blonde hair. Zoya. Volodya felt a flush of pride. "My wife," he thought, "top physicist and mother of two." She conferred with two men, the three heads close together, arguing. Volodya hoped nothing was wrong. This was the bomb that would save Stalin. Everything else had gone wrong for the Soviet Union. Western Europe had turned decisively democratic, scared off communism by bully boy Kremlin tactics, and bought off by Marshall Plan bribes. The USSR had not even been able to take control of Berlin. When the airlift had gone on relentlessly, day after day, for almost a year, the Soviet Union had given up and reopened the roads and railways. In Eastern Europe, Stalin had retained control only by brute force. Truman had been re-elected president and considered himself leader of the world.
The Americans had stockpiled nuclear weapons and had stationed B-29 bombers in Britain, ready to turn the Soviet Union into a radioactive wasteland. But everything would change today. If the bomb exploded as it should, the USSR and the USA would be equals again. When the Soviet Union could threaten America with nuclear devastation, American domination of the world would be over. Volodya no longer knew whether that would be good or bad. If it did not explode, both Zoya and Volodya would probably be purged, sent to labor camps in Siberia, or just shot. Volodya had already talked to his parents, and they had promised to take care of Kotya and Galina, as they would if Volodya and Zoya were killed by the test. In the strengthening light, Volodya saw, at various distances around the tower, an odd variety of buildings, houses of brick and wood, a bridge over nothing, and the entrance to some kind of underground structure. Presumably the army wanted to measure the effect of the blast. Looking more carefully, he saw trucks, tanks, and obsolete aircraft, placed for the same purpose, he imagined. The scientists were also going to assess the impact of the bomb on living creatures. There were horses, cattle, sheep, and dogs in kennels. The confab on the platform ended with a decision. The three scientists nodded and resumed their work. A few minutes later, Zoya came down and greeted her husband. "Is everything all right?" he said. "We think so," Zoya replied.
"You think so?"
She shrugged. "We've never done this before, obviously." They got into the truck and drove, across country that was already a wasteland, to the distant control bunker. The other scientists were close behind. At the bunker, they all put on welder's goggles as the countdown ticked away. At 60 seconds, Zoya held Volodya's hand. At 10 seconds, he smiled at her and said, "I love you." At 1 second, he held his breath. Then it was as if the sun had suddenly risen. A light stronger than noon flooded the desert. In the direction of the bomb tower, a ball of fire grew impossibly high, reaching for the moon. Volodya was startled by the lurid colors in the fireball, green, purple, and orange. The ball turned into a mushroom whose umbrella kept rising. At last the sound arrived, a bang as if the largest artillery piece in the Red Army had been fired a foot away, followed by rolling thunder that reminded Volodya of the terrible bombardment of the Selov Heights. At last the cloud began to disperse and the noise faded. There was a long moment of stunned silence. Someone said, "My God, I didn't expect that." Volodya embraced his wife.
"You did it," he said.
She looked solemn.
"I know," she said, "but what did we do?"
"You saved communism," said Volodya. 2. "The Russian bomb was based on Fat Man, the one we dropped on Nagasaki," said Special Agent Bill Bix. "Someone gave them the plans." "How do you know?" Greg asked him. "From a defector." They were sitting in Bix's carpeted office in the Washington headquarters of the FBI at 9 o'clock in the morning. Bix had his jacket off. His shirt was stained in the armpits with sweat, though the building was comfortably air-conditioned. "According to this guy," Bix went on, "a Red Army intelligence colonel got the plans from one of the scientists on the Manhattan Project team."
"Did he say who?"
"He doesn't know which scientist. That's why I called you in. We need to find the traitor." "The FBI checked them all out at the time, and most of them were security risks. There was nothing we could do. But you knew them personally."
"Who was the Red Army colonel?"
"I was coming to that. You know him.
His name is Vladimir Peshkov."
"My half-brother?"
"Yes."
"If I were you, I'd suspect me." Greg said it with a laugh, but he was very uneasy.
"Oh, we did, believe me," Bix said. "You've been subjected to the most thorough investigation I have seen in 20 years with the Bureau."
Greg gave him a skeptical look.
"No kidding.
Your kid's doing well in school, isn't he?" Greg was shocked. Who could have told the FBI about Georgie?
"You mean my godson," he said.
"Greg, I said thorough. We know he's your son." Greg was annoyed, but he suppressed the feeling. He had probed the personal secrets of numerous suspects during his time in army security. He had no right to object.
You're clean,
Bix went on. I'm relieved to hear it.
Anyway, our defector insisted the plans came from a scientist, rather than any of the normal army personnel working on the project.
Greg said thoughtfully, When I met Volodya in Moscow, he told me he had never been to the United States.
He lied, said Bix. He came here in September 1945. He spent a week in New York. Then we lost him for 8 days. He resurfaced briefly, then went home.
8 days?
Yeah. We're embarrassed.
It's enough time to go to Santa Fe, stay a couple of days, and come back.
Right.
Bix leaned forward across his desk.
But think, if the scientist had already been recruited as a spy, why wasn't he contacted by his regular controller? Why bring someone from Moscow to talk to him?
You think the traitor was recruited on this 2-day visit? It seems too quick.
Possibly he had worked for them before, but lapsed. Either way, we're guessing the Soviets needed to send someone who the scientist already knew. That means there ought to be a connection between Volodya and one of these scientists.
Bix gestured at a side table covered with tan file folders.
The answer is in there somewhere.
Those are our files on every one of the scientists who had access to those plans.
What do you want me to do?
Go through them.
Isn't that your job?
We've already done it. We didn't find anything. We're hoping you'll spot something we've missed.
I'll sit here and keep you company. Do some paperwork.
It's a long job.
You've got all day.
Greg frowned. Did they know?
Bix said confidently, You have no plans for the rest of the day.
Greg shrugged. Got any coffee? He had coffee and donuts, then more coffee, then a sandwich at lunchtime, then a banana mid-afternoon. He read every known detail about the lives of the scientists, their wives and families, childhood, education, career, love and marriage, achievements and eccentricities and sins. He was eating the last bite of banana when he said, Jesus fucking Christ.
What? Said Bix.
Willy Frunze went to the Berlin Boys Academy. Greg slapped the file triumphantly down on the desk.
And?
So did Volodya.
He told me.
Bix thumped his desk in excitement.
School friends! That's it! We've got the bastard!
It's not proof, said Greg.
Oh, don't worry. He'll confess.
How can you be sure?
Those scientists believe that knowledge should be shared with everyone, not kept secret. He'll try to justify himself by arguing that he did it for the good of humanity.
Maybe he did.
He'll go to the electric chair all the same, said Bix.
Greg was suddenly chilled. Willy Frunze had seemed a nice guy.
Will he? You bet your ass. He's going to fry.
Bix was right. Willy Frunze was found guilty of treason and sentenced to death. And he died in the electric chair. So did his wife. 3. Daisy watched her husband tie his white bow tie and slip into the tailcoat of his perfectly fitting dress suit.
You look like $1 million, she said,
and she meant it. He should have been a movie star. She remembered him 13 years earlier, wearing borrowed clothes at the Trinity Ball, and she felt a pleasant frisson of nostalgia. He had looked pretty good then, she recalled, even though his suit was 2 sizes too big. They were staying in her father's permanent suite at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington. Lloyd was now a junior minister in the British Foreign Office, and he had come here on a diplomatic visit. Lloyd's parents, Ethel and Bernie, were thrilled to be looking after 2 grandchildren for a week. Tonight, Daisy and Lloyd were going to a ball at the White House. She was wearing a drop-dead dress by Christian Dior, pink satin with a dramatically spreading skirt made of endless folds of flaring tulle. After the years of wartime austerity, she was delighted to be able to buy gowns in Paris again. She thought of the Yacht Club Ball of 1935 in Buffalo, the event that she imagined, at the time, had ruined her life. The White House was obviously a lot more prestigious, but she knew that nothing that happened tonight could ruin her life. She reflected on that while Lloyd helped her put on her mother's necklace of rose-colored diamonds with matching earrings. At the age of 19, she had desperately wanted high-status people to accept her. Now she could hardly imagine worrying about such a thing.
As long as Lloyd said she looked fabulous, she did not care what anyone else thought. The only other person whose approval she might seek was her mother-in-law, Eth Leckwith, who had little social status and had certainly never worn a Paris gown. Did every woman look back and think how foolish she had been when young? Daisy thought again about Ethel, who had certainly behaved foolishly, getting pregnant by her married employer, but never spoke regretfully about it. Maybe that was the right attitude. Daisy contemplated her own mistakes, becoming engaged to Charlie Farquharson, rejecting Lloyd, marrying Boy Fitzherbert. She was not quite able to look back and think about the good that had come of those choices. It was really not until she had been decisively rejected by high society and had found consolation at Ethel's kitchen in Aldgate that her life had taken a turn for the better. She had stopped yearning for social status and had learned what real friendship was, and she had been happy ever since. Now that she no longer cared, she enjoyed parties even more. "Ready?" said Lloyd. She was ready. She put on the matching evening coat that Dior had made to go with the dress. They went down in the elevator, left the hotel, and stepped into the waiting limousine. 4. Carla persuaded her mother to play the piano on Christmas Eve. Maud had not played for years. Perhaps it saddened her by bringing back memories of Walter. They had always played and sung together, and she had often told the children how she had tried and failed to teach him to play ragtime. But she no longer told that story, and Carla suspected that nowadays the piano made Maud think of Joachim Koch, the young officer who had come to her for piano lessons, whom she had deceived and seduced, and whom Carla and Ada had killed in the kitchen. Carla herself was not able to shut out the recollection of that nightmare evening, especially getting rid of the body. She did not regret it. They had done the right thing, but all the same, she would have preferred to forget it. However, Maud at last agreed to play Silent Night for them all to sing along. Werner, Ada, Eric, and the three children, Rebecca, Vali, and the new baby, Lily, gathered around the old Steinway in the drawing room. Carla put a candle on the piano and studied the faces of her family in its moving shadows as they sang the familiar German carol. Vali, in Werner's arms, would be 4 years old in a few weeks' time, and he tried to sing along, alertly guessing the words and the melody. He had the oriental eyes of his rapist father. Carla had decided that her revenge would be to raise a son who treated women with tenderness and respect. Eric sang the words of the hymn sincerely. He supported the Soviet regime as blindly as he had supported the Nazis. Carla had at first been baffled and infuriated, but now she saw a sad logic to it. Eric was one of those inadequate people who were so scared by life that they preferred to live under harsh authority, to be told what to do and what to think by a government that allowed no dissent. They were foolish and dangerous, but there were an awful lot of them. Carla gazed fondly at her husband, still handsome at 30. She recalled kissing him, and more, in the front of his sexy car, parked in the Grunewald, when she was 19. She still liked kissing him. When she thought over the time that had passed since then, she had 1,000 regrets. But the biggest was her father's death. She missed him constantly, and still cried when she remembered him lying in the hall, beaten so cruelly that he did not live until the doctor arrived. But everyone had to die, and father had given his life for the sake of a better world. If more Germans had had his courage, the Nazis would not have triumphed. She wanted to do all the things he had done, to raise her children well, to make a difference to her country's politics, to love and be loved. Most of all, when she died, she wanted her children to be able to say, as she said of her father, that her life had meant something, and that the world was a better place for it. The carol came to an end. Maud held the final chord, and little Vali leaned forward and blew the candle out. This is John Lee.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Winter of the World by Ken Follett. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Janet Stark. Winter of the